This episode is brought to you by Gustiamo, the online store for Italian ingredients and pantry staples. Learn more at gustiamo.com.
This episode is brought to you by Just Egg. It's a better egg made from plants. Bring more customers in your doors with Just Egg. Start with a free sample at ju.st/hrn.
This week on Meat and Three, we're talking organization. Not mise en place or keeping your knives in a row, but labor organizing.
If any restaurant worker is listening to this and is like, yes, I want something different, but I don't know where to start, first step they just need to do is to find one of us and get plugged in.
As independent contractors, they can't directly tell people, you know, when or where to work, but by using sort of gamified nudges to push people, that is sort of how they move the workforce around.
Tune in to Meat and Three, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Cooking in Mexican from A to Z. I'm your host, Aaron Sanchez, alongside my lovely mother,
Sarela Martinez.
And we are ecstatic to be inviting someone that we relate a lot to because he's a gentleman. He's a professor. His name is Victor Macias Gonzalez. He's a professor of university at Wisconsin. His specialty is Latin American, Mexican, and Latinx histories and history of gender and sexuality. So, Victor is an expert in all things from the border and how it relates to the cultural aspects, culinarily, obviously, and all this beautiful region that I hail from and my mom hails from. So we're really excited to have him here. He grew up in the Mexican border of El Paso, Texas, my hometown, to immigrant parents. So we're excited to have him here to talk a little bit about this unbelievable cross-section of cultures that is the border. So welcome, Victor. We're ecstatic to have you.
I'm very happy to be here. It's a pleasure. It's such a treat to be here with you guys.
Well, you know, I discovered Victor when I was writing about what the difference is with the people, the Mexican people who live on the border. And he explained to me that during the revolution, a lot of the Mexicans that had properties in Mexico moved to the border states. And that's accounts for it. Is that a good way of describing it?
Sure. Yeah. We had a massive influx of middle class and upper middle class people arriving during the revolution, especially when Villa was tearing up Chihuahua and Durango, right? All of the elites of the north ended up in El Paso. Just look at all the boarding schools, all of the cultural institutions they created, the social clubs they created, and also the really interesting food in El Paso, right? Because it's very different. The moment you leave El Paso and you go into Texas, the food becomes very different, right?
And what happened then? Because there's not that much food in El Paso now.
I think people are very cheap. They don't want to spend money on food.
Yeah. Not even the narcos that have moved there?
Well, the narcos take a couple of generations to clean up money.
Yeah.
I think that there's a lot of really good food, but it's kind of hard to find. And I also think that the restaurants don't sell a lot of the food that's made still at home. Mm-hmm. So I think there's like an El Paso cuisine. I think, for example, of the Lenten food, the traditional Lenten food that never even makes it to the menus. It never makes it to the menus. It never makes it to the cookbooks. So there's all of this religious holiday food and foodways attached to them that, you know, many people don't know. I was just thinking about it before we started, you know, the many different kinds of vegetables that are dipped in egg and deep fried and then served in some sort
lampreados.
Of, yeah, lampreados, all of the different lampreados, yeah, that we have that, you know, most people don't know. My Anglo relatives come and, you know, serve stuff like that. They're like, ¿qué es eso? You know, what's that? I'm like, well, didn't your mother cook any food for the holidays?
But anyway, you know, yesterday we were talking with Paula Lambert from the Mozzarella Cheese Company. And she says that the food in Dallas and in most of Texas, they will not accept any regional Mexican food.
Oh, yeah. They're not exposed to it. They don't know it. Whereas I think like El Paso, because of the large university and the large like Chicano cultural interests by young people, people really crave, they want to know more about regional food. And Juarez has changed a lot since my childhood. I was born in 1970, but we have had a lot of migrants from places like Veracruz. And so, and people travel, a lot of these Mexican-American kids travel to the interior of Mexico, and they want to eat the food that they learn, right? You know, a lot of them are curious about indigenous food. A lot of us are diabetic, and so people are trying to get back at traditional foods, thinking that's a better preparation for themselves. So there's a lot of interest. You know, there's a place there run by women that used to work for in the textile industry. They're seamstresses, and they developed this place called Café Mayapan.
I've done a benefit there. Where do you eat when you go to El Paso?
Well, no, I mean, look, and I want to hear from Victor as well, obviously. I mean, when I go there, I do all the traditional stuff. I like to go to Kiki's to get my machaca. I think that's such a particular thing that's made in El Paso that's very unique to us. So I love doing that. I love getting my burritos from L&J. And then I go to the little place. There's actually a little posada right next to the, on Mesa. I think it's called Lucy's. It's right next to the King.
Oh, yeah.
Bay. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Lucy's.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and they do fantastic breakfast there. And I crave that Mexican breakfast. I don't eat breakfast unless it's Mexican or I'm in El Paso. Because it just, We do breakfast the right way. You know what I mean? So those are some highlights.
A nice balance of vegetables and protein.
Yes, exactly.
Where do you eat when you go to El Paso?
I tell you what, there's a particular genre of food that I can't get outside of El Paso that I like to eat. And that is what I am going to call summer cooking street food. You know, in El Paso, all of our houses had massive walls of adobe, and you did not want to cook in the evening. So all of us went out. Mm-hmm. And we had our favorite places to go out to, and we would go and eat. There was a stand of ladies outside of this church, or there was a stand of ladies outside of this place, right? So what I craved is enchiladas montadas, you know, enchiladas with sausage and potatoes and a fried egg on top, right? So like they're more like minor Zacatecas style enchiladas. I really crave gorditas infladas, you know, little round corn stuffed with real simple picadillo, but the best thing, really refreshing salsas. And, you know, when we picked a place to go for tacos, we didn't just go because the meat was good. We went because the stuff that went in it was good.
Well, you know, my mom used to top it with a delicious slaw made with mint and oil and cabbage.
Cabbage, yeah.
It's just fantastic. But it's a lot of work to make those. You know, we also mentioned gorditas infladas in another program, because in Veracruz they have another type of gordita inflada, which is like papadums. You know, they're really, but the ones in Juarez are not like that.
Yeah.
No, they're very tiny. They're very tiny. The other thing that's really, really traditional to El Paso is shredded beef tacos. Mm-hmm. And they're open tacos, right? You just fold the tortilla, you put the meat in it, fold it, fry it. And then what really makes them unique are the really almost salads that go in there, right? That's what makes them really yummy, I think. There was one place we used to go to where they would make a salsa that had like a V8 base with like some sort of umami. I forget what it was they used. And then it was really a salad. It was like fresh jalapenos, fresh lettuce, fresh tomatoes, lots of different herbs, right? And shredded carrots and shredded cucumber, yeah. Right?
Mm.
Yeah, and this place, there were 50 people waiting for their tacos outside of a bakery in Juarez, you know?
Yeah.
People there love to entertain by hiring somebody to go make gorditas at their home.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
My sister loved to do that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mom, I know that you've spoken very fondly about some of those iconic restaurants that really sort of had panache and were bringing some of that sort of European sensibility as far as service and atmosphere. in Juarez, you talked about the Catacombs, right? The Catacombs restaurant. Can we talk a little bit about some of those iconic places in Juarez?
Well, I think that Victor can address that better than me. And then I will talk to you about Casa del Sol. I spent the most beautiful afternoon yesterday with two of the daughters of Luis Estavillo going over the menus. It was so sophisticated, from 1968. So, but why don't you give a little history?
Okay, sure. I think what we have to understand about the Juarez restaurant scene is that it really reflects the history, the political history, right? And so what kicks off the Juarez restaurant scene in the late Porfiriato is that it's a free trade zone. And so there's a lot of people doing business in the area, right? And you get Germans, you get American merchants, French merchants in there. So like, it's really eclectic. It's also fueled by the arrival of the railroads. So like, when I was doing some research, I found that the hotels would publish their menus. And so when you look at the menus of the hotels, they're amazing. They're like chiles rellenos de anchoas, chiles rellenos de, you know, like the most creative. And it's telling you that there's now tinned goods, processed food arriving, and people are using them, right? They're still serving the same things that were fixing during the colonial period, but they're adding new ingredients to them and making them much more eclectic. And then after the revolution, the arrival of many different groups from different parts of the country, but also the arrival of Americans, especially bootleggers, and the creation of nightclub culture during the Prohibition, and bars, and the arrival of American food, right? So you begin to see these restaurants that serve turf and surf. The turf is coming from, because of the railway, from Chicago and Kansas City, and the surf is coming because of the Mexican railway that's bringing stuff up from Sinaloa or Veracruz, right? So you get this mixture of cuisines because of the kind of railway routes that are there, right?
They didn't use the cattle from the beef from the cattle in the area?
Of course they used the beef from the cattle in the area, but they cut it differently.
Yeah, that's what we're trying to find a butcher who will interview about that.
Yeah, I think somebody should tell us about how Mexican butchers cut things differently. And when I traveled in Spain, I noticed that they also cut things differently too. It's we have different cuts.
How about if you tell them about Martino's or your Thursday ritual with your mother when she went to get to the beauty shop?
Oh yeah, sure. Well, the other thing is, you know, with the politics is the arrival of Spaniards in the area during the Civil War, and so lots of us learned about Spanish food. And it's a ritual. You know, a lot of working class people have menudo or gordito or chicharrones on the weekend, but you know, very middle class people also started eating paella on weekends. It was like a ritual. The other thing is also there's a lot of Chinese that arrived in the area, and so I was telling you that when I was a kid, my mother was a bit of a socialite, and so her party started on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, right? And so she would go and get her nails done, get her hair done. That was a whole ordeal all of Thursday, right? And so the maid wasn't there. There wasn't anybody babysitting us. So my dad would take us that day. And that was a day that we went to the movies. We went to the movies, we went to the candy store, and we went and bought books because, you know, as you can tell from behind me, we kind of like books at my house. And so after we were done, then we would go eat Chinese food.
How about the Sevillana?
Oh, La Sevillana. I love La Sevillana. La Sevillana had two dining rooms. The dining room in the front, they served like tourist food and they served like American food, fast food. And then the back, they had a dining room and, oh, it was very different. First off, you sat down and they gave you a drink. And for us kids, they would always give us eye shavings with anise del mono. And they would bring a little plate that would have cloves. And they taught me how to put the cloves between my mouth and my teeth and to suck the the anise through that. It was quite the experience for a little kid, as you can imagine. But then, you know, you called ahead and you told them what you wanted. And so they would fry up chicken. I really liked the chicken. But they would make elaborate dishes. My father always loved seafood. That was the luxury food in our house, yeah. Seafood. So he always ordered he always liked for them to make him bacalao. And so yeah. He would have bacalao. And the bread was very crispy, was very buttery. And of course, the salads were fabulous. And they would always serve you cheese also at the dessert, right? Because, you know, Hispanic cooking doesn't have very elaborate French style.
But how about Martino's? I mean, because we were talking, Aaron, that it was like an old-fashioned restaurant. And he trained all the waiters in the border, in Juarez. So when you went to eat in a Juarez restaurant, the service was amazing. And how mm-hmm. long did and that was still pretty popular until recently, no?
Te servían a la francesa, with the cloth on their side. They would always carry it around.
Mm.
Y te retiraban de este lado. I mean, they knew how to serve a table. It was good. And in some places, they knew how to clean with the brush and y la pala. You know, they would clean your crumbs away. Because in those restaurants, they served wheat bread. They never served tortillas.
Yeah.
Talking about the wheat bread, I don't remember when your dad used to go get us sweet bread from Juarez. Because even though it's right across the border from El Paso, the sweet bread that they make in El Paso does not taste anything like the one made in Juarez. And I still remember the birotes.
Yeah. Yep. And I think it's something to be said just culturally about living on the border. You mentioned having a maid. I think people might scoff at that idea here in the States, well, we had a maid. No, but if you middle class Mexican-American in El Paso, chances are you had a maid or a cook that came in from Juarez every morning and you dropped her off at the border at the end of the workday. And that was something that was very common for families in El Paso to have. And I just think,
had a gardener also.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you had a gardener, you had the maid. There was the maid that only did clothes. There was the maid who cooked.
That reminds me of a joke, but I don't think I can tell it here.
Yeah. Well, what did that mean?
And everyone had also a seamstress that fixed dresses and things like that.
But the thing is that in Mexico, even the maids have maids.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Exactly. They have like a little sort of posse that helps them out with everything and all things cooking. And obviously maintaining the house. But I think it's something to mention about how you grow up biculturally on the border and how it refers to food. And it forms opinions, especially with me, to be bicultural. You know, you speak great Spanish, you speak great English, you know, you have a foot in each culture. I think that's what makes being from El Paso and Juarez so special, you know?
And most of us also speak French.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Because especially your mom's generation.
Yep.
What?
That they speak, you guys were taught French and you went to finishing school and all that kind of stuff.
I was taught Latin. And that is the best thing I ever took because my vocabulary is great.
Oh, yeah. No doubt about it.
This episode is brought to you by Gustiamo, the online store for ingredients and pantry staples from Italy. Gustiamo's mission is to improve the quality of Italian food in the States. They independently import the best and most authentic food from Italian farmers and food makers, wonderful people dedicated to their land and their traditions. When you're searching for quality Italian pasta, San Marzano tomatoes, and real extra virgin olive oil, Gustiamo has them all. Shop their vinegars, coffees, sweets, and so much more. From northern hilltop hazelnut farmers in Piemonte to southern sea salt millers off the coast of Sicily, Gustiamo works exclusively with small family food companies in Italy. When you shop with Gustiamo, you'll know that your ingredients are authentically Italian and of the highest quality. For our listeners, Gustiamo is offering a 10% discount on your online order with Gusti code HRN. Learn more at gustiamo.com. That's GUSTIAMO.com.
This episode is brought to you by Just Egg. You can't have plant-based breakfast without a plant-based egg. Just Egg is now the fastest growing egg brand in the United States. Bring more plant-based consumers in your doors with easy-to-use Just Egg. You can get started with a free sample. Just head to ju.st/hrn. Made from plants, Just Egg is a better egg for you and for the planet. It's healthier, with no cholesterol and less saturated fat, and it's more sustainable. Just Egg uses less water and generates fewer carbon emissions. Most importantly, it's delicious. For our listeners who operate a food service establishment, you can get a sample for free. Head to ju.st/hrn. Just Egg makes a delicious, plant-based addition to any menu. It's available as a liquid scramble, great for omelets, frittatas, stir fries, and French toast. There's also frozen, pre-baked, folded version that's ideal for filling breakfast sandwiches or topping salads. Chef Jose Andreas calls Just Egg mind-blowing, and Bon Appetit says, "It's so good, I feel guilty eating it." Put the fastest-growing egg brand on your menu. Get a free sample of Just Egg for your restaurant at ju.st/hrn.
You know, I'll tell you one thing that's really interesting. People used to fight over the ladies that came to help, because that's how we were supposed to talk about it. The ladies that came to help. My grandmother, I had one grandmother that was more Marxist, and I was one that was more bourgeois. But the Marxist grandma, said, "Son trabajadoras."
Yeah.
She would always tell us that. You know, they're ladies that came to help. But they would fight over them, because the ones that knew how to cook well, or that knew how to serve the table well, were rare and difficult to obtain their services. So my great-grandmother, Doña Amelia, she used to always have the best cook. And what was really interesting is she was half Spanish from Torreón. And the ladies that cooked in her house were always people from the South. That's what we always said. Ay, mira, trae una muchacha del sur. Mm-hmm. And they served white rice, black beans, plantains. Mm-hmm. My father ran across that, an old criollo frontier family. And he's like, ¿qué es esto? How do you eat this? You know, right? And that great grandmother was amazing. She was really something. She lost her husband when she was very young, but she brought up all her kids. She sent all her kids to college. You know, all of my great aunts are teachers, professionals, and so on. But she would take her daughters to Mexico City so they could sit for their examinations. And during the day, she would go and eat. And so in my family, you know, we were middle class by Mexican standards. My grandmother knew all the good restaurants in Mexico City. You know, to this day, people in the family say, when you go to Mexico City, you have to go eat the shrimp at this one place, in La Nubia.
And in El Paso, what do they say? When you go to El Paso, you have to go eat what?
Well, you know, it's different. When people go to El Paso, a lot of them are people that have left and gone to college somewhere else, and they come back. And they want to go eat at the places that they went to eat when they were in high school. So that horrible place that people like to go to.
Chicos
those
tacos.
White tacos. I hate those damn things.
Chicos tacos.
Andale, chicos tacos. It's like the lady in the kitchen drop your tacos into your fideos, you know? And then they put that horrible yellow cheese on top. I don't care for that. If you want to give me entomatadas, give me entomatadas.
Yeah.
Pero así tacos aguados, oh no, thank you.
Yeah.
In El Paso, I think the thing that is most well known for are the meats. And I remember driving 40 miles or however long it was to the cattlemen.
The cattlemen, yeah.
And now they have one called Corralitos. And you know, when I was growing up, we spent a lot of time in El Paso, there were restaurants that were like of different backgrounds. You know, there was the Italian kitchen, and there was a Lebanese restaurant called the sword, something. And it was really wonderful Lebanese food. or Syrian mm-hmm. food. And you can, and then later on came out Rovinos, mm-hmm. which is still really popular. But mm-hmm. I don't remember, like, apart from the Café Central, I don't think that there are any really kind of fancy restaurants in El Paso right now. Am I wrong?
No, I think you're right, particularly the ones that the Mexicans would go to. I think when El Paso developed a middle class, a Mexican-American middle class, after their fathers came back from the armed forces, they went to college and they became businessmen. You know, people in the 50s and 70s, then they began to go to places that previously had been white only, had been Anglo spaces. And I think that's when Mexican-Americans learned to like steak and things like, they definitely start eating spaghetti. Spaghetti. Yeah. I think earlier, because you just mentioned Corralitos. Corralitos is a Juarez restaurant. After all of the insecurity started in Juarez, a lot of those people that had money closed things down and opened them in the El Paso side. My favorite seafood place in my childhood in Juarez was La Boquilla, and now they're over in El Paso.
Oh,
right?
Really?
Yeah. They also had Spanish restaurants that we really liked a lot, but now they didn't make a lot of money in El Paso, so they went back.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, it's kind of interesting, the movement back and forth. The other interesting side of this is, you know, how did, you know, what is it that Mexican Americans in El Paso make for Thanksgiving, right?
Yeah.
Because I grew up in my dad's family was, if you go back far enough, my dad's family is part Anglo. And during the revolution, my grandparents had to become Baptist because my grandfather was a politician. And you couldn't get ahead being Catholic because the state was fighting the Catholic Church, right? So they became Baptists. So my grandma's party food was all Baptist cooking.
Like
right?
What?
So it was like fried chicken. Like, show me a Mexican that doesn't like American fried chicken. Fried chicken and ham with pineapples.
Deviled eggs or no?
Deviled eggs, yes. But we also eat that at the Spanish restaurants, yeah. Too. They put that on top of ensaladilla rusa. Mm-hmm. The other thing that they would make are desserts, right? You know, a good apple pie, a good...
it's not typically Mexican, the apple pie.
Yeah, things that are not typically Mexican. And so those are the things that we would eat over there, right? And so, and they put on the full Thanksgiving spread. Now, part of the story is also my grandfather's family during the revolution, they ended up in Michigan. And so when they came back after the revolution, they worked at Ford Motor Company. After they came back from the revolution, they were super agringados. And so for the holidays, you know, we would serve everything, turkey, pumpkin pie, everything, all made from scratch. But the stuffing was Mexican stuffing. The same stuffing that you put inside chiles.
Chiles en nogada. Okay, but let's not get too bogged down with that, but let's keep it more contemporary because sure. I want people to relate. First of all, if they go to El Paso and if they go to Juarez, I mean, I don't know what's happening in restaurants in Juarez, but mm-hmm. but I know that they're very good Chinese restaurants. You know, there was a La Guayen and Shangri-La when I was growing mm-hmm. up, and when you mentioned that relish, they called chile amor. That is jalapenos, uh-huh. unseeded jalapenos, uh-huh. tomatoes, and onions, and lime juice. You can't imagine how fantastic that was. But that brings you to this question of Casa del Sol. This is this restaurant that was magical. I mean, they opened at the end of the 60s, and it was opened by this man named Luis Estavillo. And I spent the whole afternoon yesterday talking to his two of his daughters. He has a bunch of them. And he had this restaurant that was successful until 9/11 made him close because, you know, people could not cross the border. But in his heyday, when I was a teenager and then got married, it was full of ladies who used to come from El Paso to have lunch there. And they would eat like a tampiqueña, which is that grilled meat that they serve with an enchilada and beans. Or combination plate. The combination plate is very big in El Paso still.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. But then the Mexicans were coming.
Comida corrida.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also they had, he had brought this chef from Acapulco called Federico Ramirez. Oh. And he had this all this amazing menu, you know. With yesterday they were telling me something like it was like this fillet with fish fillet with artichokes and lemon juice and butter and you know very sophisticated food and this was like in the 60s.
Mm-hmm. There was a lot more money in the 60s.
Yeah,
it was a much smaller town in the 60s. It was a very close world.
And you think about, is this correct that the first Hilton, Conrad Hilton, opened in El Paso, right? When he was with Elizabeth Taylor. So there's, you know, and then you look at Cafe Central, which is sort of considered the best restaurant in El Paso for many, many years. And they still have that dish on the menu, the filet with the chile verde, that's mm-hmm. very famous, that's still on that menu. So, yeah, I think there was a big push to make El Paso very cosmopolitan, like so many parts during the Porfirio Diaz era all over Mexico. No, correct, Victor?
Well, not so much El Paso, but Ciudad Juarez, I think.
Yeah, Ciudad Juarez, yeah.
But I think that what places like Café Central are really interesting because today I think the name remains and the allure remains. But, you know, it was a Mexican-American owned chain. There were four of them. In the 40s through the 80s, that was the last one closed. When I remember the Café Central when I was a kid, it used to be one of the four, but it was a place that sold Chinese chop suey. It was a chop suey palace. Yeah,
my mom used to make that.
It was in downtown Juarez that for el café. We used to call it Café Central or el Café de los Chinos, and it was chop suey and the other thing that we're well known for. Was coconut custard pie. the other thing I wanted to mention is one really cool, really interesting place for foodies even today. If you think about the Anglos that have made a nice chunk of change from selling Mexican food to other parts of the country, you know, people like what is his name? Clark Kerr, I think is one
Park,
of them.
Yeah, Park Kerr.
Yeah, they get their inspiration from going to the old market, the old food markets. There was the Mercado Hidalgo and the Mercado Cuauhtémoc, and both of them had food stalls. And they had fabulous ingredients. You know, the best cheese there, the best handmade tortillas there.
The best nopalitos.
The best nopalitos. In fact, the only place where they fix nopalitos for you, there, right? Pipián, they would make pipián there. You would take it home and make it, right? So they even sold live fowl. You could go and buy the turkey and have them kill it and take it home for you, right? So that market is amazing, but also it catered to all tastes, right? So that was a place where, for example, tortas made from turkey tails were first made.
Oh, I don't know those.
Yeah, they're, you know, what the English call parson's nose, right? son tortas de colita de pavo with avocado and tomato, you know, the usual torta.
Well, you know, when the kids were little, we used to go every Saturday to Juarez when I was still married, and the kids would get, you know, like their haircut or whatever, and there used to be a guy there selling tortas de aguacate.
Oh, those were the best.
Do you remember them, honey?
Yes, Mom, I remember. Because we'll go there and get all of our sort of our shopping needs done in Juarez on Saturdays. And I remember him being very excited to do that. And I remember he would take us to a particular barber named Sadis, I think. And he would say, if you don't move, si mueves, te voy a cortar la oreja. I'm gonna cut your ear off if you keep moving. And we were like so scared to go to Señor Sadis to cut our hair. But my dad relished in that.
When you mentioned the barber, I remember my dad would go to the barber and they would ask him, and how would you like your hair done, Mr. Martinez? In perfect silence.
Exactly.
Well, I used to go with my grandfather to the barber every Friday because my grandfather would look good for his club. He used to go to the club on Fridays. So I, you know, it was very old school. The barbers in Juarez, you know, with they had an old fashioned percolator with the hot water for the shaving.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about the club culture. Cause you know, you think about places like, you know, Cuban Americans, they have that yacht culture that was very part of, you know, the Batista era before everything. So let's talk a little bit about those clubs and these social places that the elite or middle class people of Juarez and El Paso would go to and frequent.
Well, they were very exclusive. The issue with old El Paso families is they were fighting a losing battle because there was a lot of money coming into the city and they wanted to maintain their status, right? So and a lot of them did not want anything to do with money related to bars or money related to prostitution, which were places that the city made a lot of money because there were 20,000 Anglo teenagers at the fort, right?
Yeah.
So nightclubs, bars, all of that stuff. So people were very keen on maintaining those worlds separate. And so there was a social club for women. It was called El Club del Botón Rojo.
I know. I made my debut with them.
Oh, you were one of the debutantes.
Yes, I have all the pictures of my debut. And
so you're an old El Paso aristocrat then.
Yeah, so my grandmother, your grandmother had to be long in order to do your debut.
Yeah, oh, yeah. They used to do a lot of social work also. They used to do, they worked with the St. Vincent de Paul groups. And so they supported the Ciudad del Niño. They did a lot to help with this rapid growth of the city.
Yeah, you know who else made the debut at that time? Beto O'Rourke's mom.
Oh,
I didn't know that. She and I went to the same school, Dorero.
Oh, I didn't know. I didn't know that. But yeah, it was a very small world. That my mother went to the Latino Americano, the Teresiano in Juarez. Yeah, it was different. But the other places were very, very middle class were, for example, the bullfighting. El Club Taurino. There were also very lower middle class groups like what was it called? El Club de los Cantineros. So all the people that worked as waiters and in the bars, you know, they had their social club as well. So there were a lot of clubs where that organized dances where people would meet because they were keen on meeting people like themselves. They were trying to make sure that they were meeting people that were like them.
Well, you know, every Saturday and Sunday, they used to have a tardeada, a tea dance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they would bring the orchestra from Chihuahua. And we would all get dressed up, I mean, every weekend. And then the uncles and some of the parents would go and be the chaperones. Mm-hmm. You know, there was this guy, Raul Soto, who was just really sexy. And I was sitting there, please let me pick you out. Please let him take me out to dance. And finally, he would take me out to dance. And then I would grow mute, you know, but it was torture.
Oh, and do you remember what kind of food they used to serve, Sarila?
No, exactly. No.
But you remember the pretty guy that you were looking at.
Yeah. Yeah, but just, I mean, not too long ago, we're talking about 10 years ago when my prima Bella, she had her debut in Juarez, remember, Mom? And we went, and I think that was one of those special moments that I really remember, the idea of the Chamberlain. You know, we all rented out that beautiful club in Juarez where we were all at, and just seeing all the tios and the elders there drinking, and Cali was there, and all of our extended family in Mexico were there. And I remember that so vividly, Mom.
You were always fighting for service, and your Uncle Rooney would cut $100 bill in half and would give half to the waiter and say, if you take care of me, I'll give you the other half.
Yeah.
That sounds about right. Yeah. I've already remember for those parties, the hosts always put a good bottle of, or two bottles of, one of whiskey and one of brandy on the tables. That was usually the custom.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you didn't have to pay the waiter.
No, exactly.
And they had wonderful caterers, you know, to serve the food at these places, because the campestre and, you know, the social clubs basically had like a stand where they would sell, you know, hamburgers or whatever it was. But they had They had this caterer named Chonito.
Well, we've talked about Chonito. Tell me more about Chonito.
My famous rice is his famous rice. Uh-huh. But, so I learned to make that when I was like 15. It's like my creamy rice casserole. And uh-huh. he used to do all sorts of, that's the one thing that I remember, but they always made, it was always like a chicken breast and probably some meat. I don't think that we ate a lot of fish then, except at Wyatt's cafeteria.
The other thing that they would serve at those parties that I remember very clearly were the beef salad, the salpicón.
Yes.
They would also make tongue sandwiches.
Yeah. Con lengua. Yep.
But it was like a spread. It was a spread of tongue with pickles and chiles, also pickled on top.
Yeah, like deviled ham.
Andale, like deviled ham, but it was tongue. And they would wrap them. It was a big pile. It would be a big silver platter. And it was a gigantic platter of these damn things. It was a bigger than a turkey. And they were all individually wrapped in paper napkins to keep the bread from burning.
Yeah, I remember.
But a lot of the stars also came to the cabarets and performed in Juarez. Doña La Negra performed there. People like Maria Felix, I don't think, would come there.
Whoa.
But all of the tropical dancers and performers, they were called cabareteras. They would perform.
Yeah, there was a beautiful movie about that.
Yeah, that movie. That was shot in Juarez.
The Four Cabareteras?
Yeah.
Bellas de Noche.
No, not that one, but that is one of those movies. There was a movie about a woman from a fancy family in Guadalajara that had to dance in a club to make money. And the implication was she was prostituting herself. And she had to go do it in a place where nobody would recognize. And of course she came to Juarez because it's a city of sin. Everybody thought it was a city of sin because of all the nightclub performance, stuff like that. Mm. But anyway, yeah, Juarez is a very special place for me in my mind. And I wish that I could do more work and more research and record. I'm realizing that our foodways are changing and many of our family traditions are being lost. And it's important to save them, I think.
Yeah. Well, you're doing such valuable work, Victor. And can you please share with our listeners how they can engage with you and keep up with all of your research and all of your wonderful work, because you really, truly are a resource and this unbelievable representative of border culture and where we're from. So can you share with our listeners how to get in touch with you with an email or something, your website?
Well, you can, if you would like to get in contact with me, the easiest thing is to just Google my name, mm-hmm. and you will find Victor Macias Gonzalez, and you will find my university webpage.
Great.
And you will find my email there. But my email is very long, so I won't give it to you.
Yeah.
It's vmaciasgonzalez@uwlax.edu.
Gotcha.
I right now I'm working on a book about gay culture in Mexico. And I'll have to share this real quick.
Yeah.
When I was a kid in the 70s, my grandfather invested in a restaurant, and he bought a restaurant. And my mom was kind of told, here, go get your PIN money, go make money off of this thing. And it was a restaurant, and all of the employees were gay men. This was a restaurant on Mina.
Was your grandfather gay?
No, not at all. I don't know how he bought it or why it was, but it turned out that this was the most important gay workplace in Juarez. And what they were very famous for was for making gigantic Sonora style flour tortillas, because you have to use a lot of strength.
I remember that at the ranch, you know, we had somebody who made them, and she had really fat arms. And then mm-hmm.
Would she stretch them this way?
Yeah, and so she would turn them from one hand to the other like that. But these were gigantic. They were like the Sonora tortillas almost.
Yeah, these were gigantic tortillas, and they would put two chile rellenos. Yeah. And you know, the usual, it's a little smear of beans and your chile rellenos, and you roll it up. And there's never sauce. There's never goop on it. They're nice, dry. They're easy to eat. You know, it's food that you can eat on your way to work or at work, right?
Yeah, exactly. But I just wanted to thank you, Victor, profusely for your time, for all your insight, for your unbelievable research that you continue to do. And you give us a lot of pride, as a proud El Pasoan and Mexican American, to see what you're doing and preserving our culture in the way that you do in a distant land like Wisconsin. I applaud you so much for that. I know my mom and I are extremely ecstatic to have you here. I think we can have a whole other conversation just based on El Paso food and on all these little subsection restaurants and hole in the walls. And I think we'll definitely revisit that at some time, but we thank you so much. And I hope everyone has enjoyed this episode of Cooking in Mexican from A to Z. We've been talking about crossing border cultures, talking about the food, how it relates to this very specific part of America and Mexico. So I hope you guys have enjoyed this this unbelievable conversation with Victor. Please look him up. He's an unbelievable resource and just such a great representative of the border. And we really appreciate all you guys listening to Cooking in Mexican from A to Z on Heritage Radio Network. Muchísimas gracias.
Hasta luego.
Hasta luego.
Cooking in Mexican from A to Z is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without your support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.